Technology, the culture or logos of technique, identified long ago by Jesus when he pointed to the devout who measured their spiritual worth by the length of their phylacteries and the quantity of their prayers, is a different thing than ascesis, science, art, or craft. The culture of technology is the celebration of and loyalty to techniques, devices, and processes as the salvation of humanity. The ascesis that Jesus counseled and practiced, the science of his science, and the art of his art, if you will, was his divine capacity to see the truth and beauty of people and things, and therefore thereby to bring them to the health of knowing their place, the relational home in the divine commonwealth. This is a reception of and an affection for the world in all the fullness and depth of its subsisting relationships. Necessary focal practices are where the fitting tool, the needed skill, the beautiful art of hand, the dance or hymn, open the self to a gift already present. The radical hospitality of Jesus' table fellowship, of his healings, of his teaching, and of his very being are invitations to recover the full and true relational self from captivity by techniques and oppressive social patterns. I'm going to use two words here, and I hope you understand them. The ratio, the discursive capacity of the human mind and hand to search and research, to skillfully develop and use tools, is not abandoned for an abstracted intellectus. Rather, the ratio, as Aquinas noted, is a prosthetic aid, a tool to bring the self to the intellectus. This intellectus is what Heraclitus called a listening into the being of things. Joseph Pieper notes that not only the Greeks, Aristotle no less than Plato, but the great medieval thinkers as well held the path of discursive reason is accompanied and penetrated by the intellectus, untiring vision, which is not active, not truly passive, rather it's receptive, a receptivity operating in the intellect and in the being. Merton offers an invitation into the life of the intellectus as a disciplined attending to the true self. His resistance to the digitized single vision of modernity, the violence of its institutional processes, and its blindness to the depth of human relationality in place and in community propelled him into solitude. The ethos of monastic solitude is in the depths of the gift it finds in its particular place. The work of prayer and hands, by being fitting to that particular place and human being, empty out the self to a unity with holy being. By contrast, the culture of technology is a metaphysical construct that creates a mythos disconnected from the relational complexity and the human ethos of living in the household of a holy being. Therefore, its ethics are ones of the straight-faced approbation of a schizoid society, the self-deception of division. For Merton, this is the insanity of the collective commitment to technology as it commodifies, programs, and manufactures human selves, desires, and a world. In a talk Merton gave to his novices in June of 1966, he jokingly suggests, "What the hell do I know about technology? I get into that bloody steel building over there and I'm lost," referring to a new building constructed at the Abbey. But in other places, notably in his comments near the end of his life, as in the essay quoted above from Gandhi on nonviolence, he speaks of technological civilization as a cult of technical power that has replaced divine messengers with machines, creating a crisis of sanity. In an article written for a short-lived Dominican journal in 1967, a year before his death, entitled The Angel and the Machine, Merton writes, "We meet the angels, the messengers of divine help. For me, the wolves on that night long ago, on the frontiers of our own freedom and our own capacity. They touch us when we reach our natural limits. This is why to us they are terrible, not only because they are greater than we, not only because they belong to the sacred world of the totally other, but because we do not usually meet them except when we ourselves are at the end of our strength, our endurance, and our understanding, or of our capacity to hope and to believe. The angel appears when we ourselves are reduced to the center of our deepest need. When we have come to face the reality of our own deepest need, our dependence on powers beyond ourselves, the face of the sacred messenger appears. In order to curtail this, to prevent the recognition of the deepest need, we create mechanisms and processes, artificial environments, abstracted from the reality of the mystery of our contingency. This culture of technology insists it is human progress, a distancing from the fact of our dependence. The machine, the technical process, and the managed program have replaced the divine messenger." Merton writes, "Technological civilization is, as we have it now, a civilization without angels. It is a civilization in which we have chosen the machine instead of the angel. That is, we have placed the machine where the angel used to be, at the limit of our own strength, at the frontier of our own capacity. But now we can view our limits without fear and without the need of invisible helpers. The machine is fully visible, and though the world of machines is itself something of a mysterious tremendum, it becomes more so with computers, incidentally, yet the machines are now our angels. We made them, not they themselves. They are, we think, entirely in our own power. They become then extensions of our own intelligence, our own strength. We do not have to walk to the edge of an infinite void in order to feel the brush of their unpredictable wings upon us in the starlight. They form part of our own enclosed and comfortable world. They stand between us and nature. They form a kind of room in which we are isolated from the rest of creation, and therefore all the more from spiritual beings. As we live in the small room, as I lived in my small room of my own making, we become more isolated from the reality of our physical dependence and our contingency. It is not the case that the technical devices, the walls, the floor, and ceilings of the room escape these realities. Rather, they disguise them. They hide them from sight and can prevent the visceral feel of them from entering into our imagination. The face of the other, mediated by the screen, can avoid touching us or demanding from us a recognition of a shared physical reality. I picked up the telephone one day in my office when I was proud. Very proud that day. I was the first chaplain of the University of Alberta to have a computer on my desk. It was an 086. It had no memory. It could print one page of text, and then it crashed. I was so proud. I had the technological device to overcome all of the distance that I felt between me and every member of the universe. One day, the telephone rang, a voice of someone who needed to hear me talk and needed to exchange in human intercourse, something I was beginning to not know anything about, heard click, 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 and said, "Who? What the hell are you doing?" And I said, I'm looking at my computer screen, and hung up. The extension of our physical power and magnification of the discursive calculations of our mind has meant the atrophying of the human capacity to feel reverence for the other, human, non-human, or divine, and to know the inescapable reality of our relatedness to these others. We once knew, fearfully perhaps, and never completely, by sheer contact, that our being, our self, was a place of conversation, a feeling the touch and breath of others. The great commandment, the law of Moses, Plato's dialectic of the same and other, all witness to a world of human experience in which we knew ourselves by living in an ethos of others and the same, in a mythos of spirits and divinity that touched and walked with us. Narcissus was recognized as deranged by his self-obsession. Today, we live in a culture that encourages such derangement, widens and extends self-absorption and obsession into all realms of human life. Mechanism and process replace human contact. We construct a self from and as a monitored image and reality in the flow of data and objects used and consumed in the maintaining of images. Lee Hupnacki, who was a close friend of Illich, in the report of his Camino, his pilgrim walk to Compostela in Spain, writes, "Today's irrational beliefs, however, are usually lacking any sensible ground or foundation. They point to abstract, oftentimes arbitrary constructs or fantasies, such as GNP, insurance systems, technological solutions. The people who walked to Compostela in years past could see and touch the sacred objects that remained from the lives of people who manifestly reached heroic heights of virtue. The angels have receded from our awareness, not because we have become more earthly, more attached to the world. Rather, our technological skill and shell has grown so thick we have lost contact with the earth except as a commodity or a piece of data to be calculated or processed. The rain is no longer the rain or the soil the soil. They are natural resources." We should talk about that expression. "The friend is no longer the friend. She is a node in a network. The sacred, risky, wondrous, awe-filled world has receded to become a background, a landscape, and I confess, for me, a screensaver for my laptop. It's not merely that we try to live in a community of human definition. That is a problem in and of itself. Rather, we more and more live in a collectivity marked by mechanical exchanges where our own face and the face of the human other only is pronounced real if it appears as an image in the show of our screens." I'm just about there. The mythos of the culture of technology is the mythos of apps, of applications. A world, in fact, of applications. The applications, the devices, the routines are the focus of attention, and the atpuai, as Levinas called it, the other, are mere data to be manipulated, simulated, rendered by appliances and applications, software, hardware, programs, and techniques to the user. Application has replaced the risk and complexity of relationship and encounter with creation. The body has become a monitored body, only pronounced real because it has been recorded by some device. It is ineffable, physical reality as the place of touching and meeting the other is replaced by the scan and readout. The risk, the mystery, the contingency of sheer physical engagement becomes a programmed performance. And the ineffability of death, the beauty and mystery of mortal flesh, becomes a failure of technique. James, my elder James, on that Sunday morning, took me by the hand, and he led me from the chapel that actually he had helped build. He could remember forming the arches of the roof. Incidentally, the chapel had no insulation, and it leaked all the time. And I finally found out because I went up and discovered that there was that space up there, and they told me it was going to be a good place for a smokehouse for fish, which was probably a better purpose than what I used it for.